Have you got some great songs but no one is listening? Are you struggling to find your audience? Worry no longer. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book and download a copy of the free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. It talks about growing your fan base, finding your niche, and getting your music out there. The essential foundations you need and the steps to take to get your music heard. How to Get Your Music Heard. Get it now at musiciansmap.org/free-book. Welcome to the Musicians Map podcast. You know, I've been thinking about influence, what influences us as musicians, but also as music fans, and often I think about genre, specific artists and albums, movements, and live music venues. There's a venue in the town where I live called the Yacht Club. I'm only new to this town, but the venue has been around for a couple of years, and the guys who run it are really starting to create a name for themselves on a worldwide scale. It's reached the point where world-renowned artists are coming to a town which, in peak season, has less than 4,000 residents, rather than playing major cities of a few hundred thousand people. And everyone living here is benefiting so much from these incredible artists and enjoying all the amazing music coming through our small town. And now you're benefiting from it as well, because the Yacht Club attracting awesome artists is how I was able to interview my guest this week, who is someone very special indeed. I'm talking to producer and composer, Mark DeCliveleau. It's tricky to define Mark's music. His recordings are prolific and eclectic. His live performances are like a music production masterclass, creating, improvising, and live sampling on the fly. His gigs flow through a mixture of electronic, jazz, R&B, dance, funk, Latin, world, and multiple other genres. And as a listener, you feel part of the process, dancing, moving, and watching as the music unfolds in front of you. I caught up with Mark the day after his Yacht Club gig with Omar, and we talked about his early years, his progression through genres, jazz, how he started with electronic music, finding his voice, and harnessing the power of expression. We also discuss his gear, his live setup, his preferred hardware and software, live sampling, live producing, signal flow, improvisation, and collaboration.
I was born in Auckland. My mum's Japanese. My dad was a Kiwi. I started playing piano at age 4 because my dad decided that, you know, come hell or high water, if I have children, they'll all bloody well learn musical instruments.
Yeah.
You know, he was old school.
Yeah.
So, yeah, age 4 on the piano, doing classical music, doing school, you know, piano competition at school and stuff like that. And then I started wanting to play more jazz because my dad had big band records, like a great vinyl collection. And my older brother was playing a bit of piano, so I wanted to play what he was playing. And my teacher didn't know what to do. He taught Beethoven and Bach, and that was it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, boogie-woogie wasn't even an option.
Yeah.
So I kind of had to kind of go my own way and started jumping into different things. And like, I remember my brother had like some songbooks, like a Beatles songbook and a Supertramp songbook and stuff like that. And I just started getting into that stuff. So whatever I could get access to.
What sort of age is this?
This is like 11.
Yep.
11, 12.
So you'd already had like a good 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, I could play the piano, but yeah. I couldn't relate to the expression of playing, you know, Mozart at that time. I remember going into high school in Auckland and all my friends were into, you know, they're all into Smashing Pumpkins and shit like that. And I could appreciate it, but it didn't resonate with me.
Mm.
And I didn't know why that was. And one day before school, I was maybe 14, my boy Joe walks up to me before school with his Walkman and his earphones and put them on my head. And it was the first album by Guy, which is produced by Teddy Riley. And that was like the start of what became New Jack Swing. And it was a whole movement in, you know, urban, black American R&B crossover pop music.
Mm.
Which when I heard that shit, I was like, wow, I can hear this. And in hindsight, I think it's because a lot of it's keyboard based.
Yeah.
And I didn't relate to the guitar as an instrument,
sure,
which is why the other stuff didn't resonate as much. So I was just like, wow, this is me. And I got into Native Tongues hip hop and this is like 91, 92, even 1990. I was buying drum machines and keyboards, just started making loops. I don't know what I was doing. There's no correlation between growing up playing piano and then having keyboards and drum machines and making music. I couldn't make that link kind of in a intellectual way.
Yeah.
I was just making loops. I connected with, there was a band called Semi MCs, who were like a seminal New Zealand, that was that time, that they were the urban New Jack Swing boy band, like 1990 or so. I met them at some talent contest and they're like, man, you want to roll with us? And so this is all like, you know, South Auckland crew, and they all have extended crew who are rappers and DJs and all this kind of thing. So I started hanging with this whole crew, which I didn't grow up with, but I suddenly found myself, here were the people doing music. Guys at school weren't doing music. That's like, you know, partying, doing their thing. So I fell in with this lot, and that was really cool because it included people like, there's a crew called Enemy Productions, which the rapper, he's Dehamo.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So that was back in the day when he was young, and him and his brother, Johnny, had this thing. And then they finished that, and we started a band together called Select One that was like trying to be Belle of DeVoe, basically, or some shit like that. And that was that time, like in the early 90s for me, that was all about that. And then one day, I was always mad extreme in my character. I woke up one day and I just thought, man, just making all these loops is bullshit. This is some fucking loop bullshit. This is not music kind of thing.
Yeah.
I sold all my vinyl, all my keyboards, my drum machines, and it was just piano and Miles Davis and John Coltrane and Herbie Hancock records, and that was it.
Yeah.
I was just this is my music kind of thing. And so I kind of dove head first into, you know, kind of jazz Nazi kind of territory. It's like, this is everything. And I reconnected with the piano through that.
Sure.
Which is cool. So like late teens, I was getting to that. I wanted to live in New York and play with Betty Carter and Art Blakey, you know, jazz legends who were still alive then.
Yeah.
I ended up going to Japan for my last year of high school, and my host father, so I was half Japanese, so it was cool anyway culturally, but my host dad, he's a Buddhist priest, but he was a jazz fiend.
Oh, man.
And I didn't know this, right? So I'm 17, I go to Japan kicking and screaming. I wanted to do my senior year in New Zealand and just, you know, fuck around and chill.
Yeah, but you were told to go to Japan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm walking around the house one day, it's 2 weeks in, and I hear this ridiculous music coming from his little study. And all I know about him is he's the head Buddhist priest for this temple.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, knocking on the study door. I'm like, you know, Tōsan sumimasen. I'm like, you know, Dad, excuse me, what are you listening to? He's like, oh, this is a new Miles Davis Live at the Plug Nickel box set. Just came out today. I was like, what the fuck? He's like, oh, you want me to get you one? So he calls up the store and orders a second box set of this limited edition thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Buddhist priests have their own economy, you know, it's like the Catholic Church in a way.
Sure, yeah.
But he's very generous in that respect. And so we go out every night to jazz clubs. There were 60 jazz clubs in Tokyo at this time.
Oh, man.
So we'd go and see American touring artists, local artists. And I fell in love with that. I totally romanticized the lifestyle of that. Because all the jazz clubs in Tokyo in the early 90s were modeled after 50s and 60s New York and Paris. And, you know, the Japanese are good at copying stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, we dig this, so we're going to do it authentically. So I saw this stuff, and I go back to New Zealand after that year, my last year of high school, enrolled for law school, knowing I was not going to law school. And I remember waking up one morning on the first day, and my dad's knocking on my bedroom door. He's like, Mark, you know, university starts today. It's like, actually, no, I'm not going. I'm going to do music and go back to sleep.
Really? Like on the day?
On the day.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was a great moment just to, yeah, in hindsight, a law degree would be useful actually, you know?
Yeah.
but at the time, that was what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So it just became a pursuit of like, I want to do music, and it was all about the jazz thing still. It was interesting because I kept going through these stages and they eventually tell one whole story between the jazz and what was just hip hop at first. But in this case, we had a jam band down at Cause Celeb, this club in Auckland City. There was the Box and Cause Celeb. It was two rooms. The Box is like the DJ vibe. Cause Celeb was a chill-out room. So they had bands there sometimes. So I'm playing all these serious jazz head gigs around Auckland. And then once a month, we'd have the jam band gig at Cause Celeb with DJs and two drummers and rappers, and it'd be Nathan Haynes and that crew. We were all young and just in that having fun vibe.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I remember playing a jazz gig in the Auckland Town Hall on stage, playing this shit, like a serious acoustic jazz thing, and having a thought while I'm playing. It's like, why am I being so serious about this shit when I could be serious about the fun thing we do once a month? And it's kind of this thing twigged in my brain, which made me realize that I could choose the focus. Like I'd felt probably ego compelled to be in the thread in the acoustic jazz world and be really serious about that.
Yep.
But it was a nice moment to be able to relax and just be like, wait, what do I want to do? What do I want to focus my energy on? Mm. And that just opened a whole world. And it was right when Jungle was happening, drum and bass was really popping. And as a musician hearing that shit, like there was an acid house thing in Auckland in the interim, and I didn't really relate to that. So I was kind of going from, you know, native tongues hip hop through a whole lot of heavy jazz, and I was waiting for something else, and then I heard Jungle and drum and bass. And that made perfect sense.
So up until that point, you were intent on being a like serious traditional jazz musician.
Yeah.
Do you think part of the reason, you know, you sort of mentioned that you woke up and you were like, I don't really actually want to be going down that path. I want to do what's fun.
Yeah.
Like, do you think the draw to jazz is maybe like some kind of, you know, because jazz musicians are so elite, you know?
Yeah, well, yeah. And I think there's different paradigms in generalizing about what a jazz musician is, right?
Mm.
But there's definitely a school of thinking where it's like, it's the idea of mastering an instrument to the point where your improvised voice can manifest in real time in any given situation, which is different to the amazing skill of like a session musician who hones their chops and their focus to such a point that they deliver the perfect performance.
Mm.
That's an amazing skill.
Yeah.
That shit's incredible. No question about it. But there's a mentality in some jazz circles where, yeah, therefore we have a purity of art form, therefore this is some serious music. And for me, it was always a juxtaposition I was torn between. Like the way it's become full story now, where the jazz and the beat side and the club side, the hip hop, the house, the breaks, all that's become one language for me.
Mm.
For me, that's the perfect balance of, you know, there's an intellectual side, there's a very earthy side, there's a more kind of ethereal side to it, and it's in balance with all these things that I love.
Mm.
But I had to go through extremes along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when I went to move to London for 10 years, I didn't play the piano. Like people would say, yo, Mark, you want to come and play a jazz gig? It's like, no, I'm good. Like, let's do a trio hit. It's like, no. It's like, yo, Mark, let's put some piano on this track. It's like, no, let's put some Juno on this track.
Okay, so you don't mean like you didn't play keys. You didn't play like acoustic piano.
Yes, yep. And there's a complete difference.
Yep.
You know, the acoustic piano is a real instrument. You know, I love digital and analog synths and stuff, but you know, the piano is wood, metal, hammers. It's the laws of physics.
Yeah.
It's air. So yeah, it's amazing. And I feel like I was emotionally scarred from it because I was forced to play this shit when I was four.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, some kids are like, you know, it's why do you play the saxophone? They're like, yeah, I just loved it. I just wanted to play it.
Mm.
I wasn't like that. I had to play the piano.
Yeah.
So I felt like I had to kind of divorce it. And I was very consciously being a Judas to the piano and to the idea of being a jazz musician. I was like, we're making club music. It's all about how subversively can I include that side of me? Like what I loved about club music was getting people to a point where they're really getting down and they're really getting off on the sonics of the drums and the groove. But there's all this musical information being fed to them subliminally. That I've done gigs where the people are basically raving to free jazz and they don't know it.
Yeah.
And that for me is the shit. It's just like, you know, I genuinely have a passion for these different, I guess, genre aesthetics.
Mm.
So it's a very genuine expression for me. But I love that it can be that combination of like the kind of hypnotic trance of electronic rhythm with some of the organicness of human expression.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see, like, I haven't seen you play before.
Right.
And last night, it's exactly kind of as you describe. My wife and I are sitting there and we both, you know, been musicians for years. And so we were kind of getting off on the rhythm of things, you know, so we're dancing and stuff, but yeah. getting off even more so on just those crunchy chords.
Yeah.
And every now and then, and you're going, oof, you know, or like a certain change or something, you know, and it's really, really jazzy.
And, but that's also interesting what I learned that actually through club music was that in club music, every sound is functional.
Yeah.
No sound is not functioning. In a jazz environment, you could arguably say that some notes are not functional.
Okay.
Like there's embellishment that supports the expression of a note.
Yeah.
Like instead of playing one note, you might be playing, you know, a chord leading into it, or a note leading into it, and a note leading out of it, and it kind of sits it in a more organic setting. I think with club music, everything's very specific. Even when people chop samples, the way the sample's chopped is specific, right? Yeah, there's an intention with it that for me, the technology is about keeping that detail. So even if I'm playing organically, I'm still being very conscious about how much I'm playing or how little I'm playing, or that I'm playing something that I'm about to sample. There's a consciousness to that process. So I'm kind of in my head, I'm producing the whole time.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm just playing piano, say on a jazz gig, I'm playing piano the whole time and I'm listening to the form and arrangement as you do as an empathetic listener in a band.
Yeah.
But in this setting, I'm fully producing because I'm controlling all the sound.
How long did it take you to get to that point?
I just got to yesterday.
Yeah.
I just got to today. I mean, it's a process. And so in 99, I did a 98, I did a trip around the world, went to London for the first time, met a whole lot of crew there, got very entrenched with the West London scene there, went through Cuba, New York, just all around the world for a year. And I come back and make a diary album, which ended up being an album called 6 Degrees.
Yep.
So on 6 Degrees, I had an MPC because I'd seen all my boys in London using MPCs and SP1200s and making beats. And all these guys, like, they weren't musically trained, but the way they cut samples and make beats was the hippest shit I'd ever heard. Like, they were doing things a musician wouldn't do.
Yeah.
Like a traditional musician. So I bought an MPC on my way back to New Zealand. I just had the MPC, the Rhodes, and a synth. And I demoed up this album, just wrote the music, recorded a few friends, the musicians in Auckland on it, had Andy Morden, Submariner, Jus Langveld, and Chris Chetland from Cog Transmissions.
Oh, yeah.
They co-produced kind of a few tracks, helped me with the engineering.
Yeah.
And then the album came out on Cog. And so touring that, I basically had the drums and the drum patterns pre-programmed in the MPC. I had a live bass player, a live drummer playing kind of second drums to the MPC beats.
Yeah.
Manuel Bundy was on cuts on turntables, and then I had keys as well. So I was primarily playing kind of Rhodes and building synth bass parts, but the drum patterns were already set.
Sure.
So I might mute a kick or, you know, do basic shit to the arrangement.
Yep.
Go to the next pattern. So then I'm doing a gig in Budapest, and it was a sick gig, and we did the encore in the set because we needed to play a longer set.
Yep.
And it was smashed, the gig was great. So we come off stage and the people are just insisting we play more. And my immediate thought is, I have no more. Nothing else is programmed.
Yeah.
So I'm like, nah, same to the promoter. I'm like, I'm good, I'm tired, and I'm too high, whatever it might be, any excuse, right?
Yeah.
You know, the dog ate it kind of thing. And he was so insistent, and at some point I gave in. And the guys are like, what are we going to play? I was like, I don't know. So I remember walking on stage, kind of eyeballing my MPC, really, really nervous. Because you imagine you have a drum machine, you know, kicks and snares on a big system. As soon as you touch that shit, it's heard.
Yeah.
It's not like you're in the bedroom making a beat and then you're confident in it and then you go and play it to someone.
Yep.
So I, you know, put the MPC in record mode and just started building a beat. And it was the weirdest feeling. It was so nerve-wracking but amazingly fulfilling. And it reminded me of playing jazz.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was like, this is wow. I can actually capture a moment and be an integrity to my expression of that moment, but then use that moment, like, it's like when you're sampling records, I'm like creating the sample and let's build from there. And so it's a very linear process. And once I did that, once I got into that, I never pre-programmed anything again.
Really?
So, you know, every gig is unique.
It is.
I used to save the gigs, the data, but now I'm like, fuck it, whatever. So I might do a solo gig for 2 or 3 hours. It's like making 3 albums on stage.
Yeah.
And then I'm just like, cool, delete.
You know? Oh, I guess there's a kind of beauty to that, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's just for then.
It's just for then. And then if I record the 2-track and I hear something that's really dope, like say I might build a track and then I'll resample it and then I'll filter and chop up the sample and I'll rebuild a track inspired by that sample.
Yeah.
So the process is, you know, there's some kind of totaling to it. Without the previous step, you can't get the next step.
Yep.
Right? So then there's a really dope thing happening and I listen back to it later on. I'm like, yeah, I want to do that. I can't recreate that. I would have I would have to go through. I can
undo the whole process.
Yeah, I can approximate it, but it's a destructive process even live. Like I'm not using data in a way where I can undo everything anyway.
Yep.
So even if I saved it, there's already destructive stuff happening. I love that whole kind of concept. That's the ideology behind how I like to perform. Whether it's, you know, I have that set up with a whole jazz group sometimes, and I can live sample the sax or the grand piano I'm playing and flip it with the beats. So whether it's with the band or solo or whatever it is, I love that the expression is always genuine about this is today, this is here, this is now.
Yeah.
If you press play on my shit, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Nothing.
How much of your samples have you got? Like, are you traveling with sample packs that you've just sort of got built into your gear and you sort of can build on them?
Yeah. So I have... I mean, everything's software-based now. Yep. It used to be like an MPC 3000 and an analog synth and an analog loop pedal. Like that's how it started.
Mm.
And that shit sounded so good too. Like I've only just got to a point recently where I can get the digital sound as fat as I want it.
Yeah.
Like analog just was, you couldn't beat it.
Huh.
And now I think technology is improving.
Yeah.
Thankfully. But anyway, so I have... the heart of the system is Native Instruments Machine.
Yep.
So Machine, I have like all my drum kits loaded up and a whole lot of soft synths loaded up. The drum kits, a lot of them are my MPC drum kits.
Yep.
From like 10 years of using the MP.
Yeah.
Other ones are some, you know, some factory kits that I've just tweaked and, you know, messed around with the sounds. Or there's certain soft synths I like to use. I like the Arturia stuff.
Yep.
I like the Korg stuff. And Native Instruments Complete. That shit's amazing.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of tweakability. It's like you can really get into shaping and molding a sound, and I love that. I think growing up playing piano, there's such a purity in a piano sound, and that's all it can do.
Mm.
You can't even play in between the notes. You know, that's all it does. So I think for me, having this infinite palette now is really cool, and I love sculpting things sonically with the frequencies. Yeah, that's the part of DJ culture I love.
Yeah,
deep in the mix, and
yeah.
I'm like, well, why can't that be part of the live thing? And some people, a lot of people, don't get it. Like, I had someone after the gig was like, "Man, you were the DJ, bro. A wicked DJ set." And I used to feel away about that, but now I'm like, well, if that's what you want to call it, whatever.
Yeah,
like, good luck to the next DJ you see if you expect them to do this.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
It's not gonna happen. It's like, bro, I thought you were gonna DJ. Come on, you're just playing records.
Yeah,
bro.
Yeah.
I like people that understand it, but I'm not going to, I don't care if they miss it. Like,
yep.
Yeah. And the people who do get it, I know they really get it.
Yeah.
Like, wait, that actually just happened.
Yeah. 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 That was us last night looking at it. So let's talk about the live sampling stuff because that uh-huh. really intrigues me, man. How are you capturing that and how are you getting, where is the signal going? Can you talk us maybe through the signal flow?
So I have 2 chaos pads that are locked in sync with Machine, which is the Machine sitting actually inside Ableton. So Ableton's the master clock.
Yep.
And one of the chaos pads, I can send any channel from the Mackie submixer on stage.
Okay.
So last night I had my main keyboard and Omar's vocal. I could send either of those to the chaos pad at any time and just sample on that. And the chaos pad is really rudimentary for sampling, but I love the limitation of it. Like the whole problem with technology is there's no limitation. So sometimes you get confused. Where do I stop?
Yeah.
Chaos pad can only do like a couple of things.
Okay.
So it's like a little 4-track sampler. It can't sample very long, but I use that. And so if I was when I'm with the full band on that mixer, I'd be able to choose sax, trumpet, the grand piano, the vocalist, whatever it might be. And then I had a drum return, a mix of the live drums coming into my audio interface, which I could sample on Ableton directly. So if Omar jump on the drums, I just want to grab a hat groove or something, I'm just, you know, recording that straight away. And then the in machine is a drum machine. It's all one shot sounds.
Mm.
So there's no like kind of drum loops and stuff. So yeah, everything is created hit by hit as it goes. Yeah.
So I noticed you're capturing some of Omar's vocal last night.
Uh-huh.
You were kind of recording the sample and then slowly bringing it up to speed to match something else that you were doing. Is that right?
Yeah, so I mean, sometimes once I've sampled his voice or an audio source, if I change the tempo, then the sample's going to pitch with that tempo.
Yeah.
So that can create some really cool effects. You know, especially say if we're doing like a up-tempo kind of house breakbeat joint, it's like, you know, 125 BPM, and I get a vocal sample out that. And then I slow the shit down to like something, some real dirty head nod vibe at like 80 BPM.
Mm.
Then that sample pitches all the way down.
Yeah.
And it becomes texturally really interesting.
Yeah.
I love that shit. It just brings it's bringing a humanity to the electronics.
Yeah, it really is. But it's it flows.
Mm.
You know, there's no kind of like, and that's the end of that song. And now we're going to start a new song. Here's the hook, you know. It's just sort of everything is just flowing. It's like the entire gig is like one sort of movement.
That's the DJ shit I love. You know, that's what I love about DJing.
Yeah.
And so that's when someone says, oh, good DJ set, bro. Like, mate, that's almost a compliment, you know. It's like, if you thought I was just DJing, cool.
Yeah, yeah.
After I sweat bullets for you.
So are you touring with loads of your own gear, or are you getting gear at each venue? How does that work?
I have a Mackie mixer and two keyboards supply each gig.
Yep.
And like some hardware, table stands and stuff.
Yep.
Everything else I travel with. So chaos pads, USB controllers, loads of cables, power adapters. Yeah, it's a pretty intensive setup. Like, it's challenging when there isn't a lot of setup and soundcheck time.
Mm.
So festivals are difficult. So now I've learned to like when we do Splore this weekend, I'm going to be there two bands before us, side of stage with a table, getting everything set up, praying that the stage crew are cool enough to carry this shit on stage for me. And yes, I've got to be prepared in advance.
Yep.
But it's worth it for me. It's like, it's the minimum amount of gear I need to do what I want to do. Like any thought I have musically, I can create.
Yep.
And in a form that I know how to control and shape. It's really, I mean, the feeling's amazing when it's in flow.
Mm.
And like last night was like that. It's like technology isn't always perfect. It has glitches and stuff. So when it's all running smoothly, which it was last night, and I'm like, I can trust the technology tonight. The sound is good. The vibe is good. Then it's just play. It's like just chucking shit around for me, playing. Yeah. You know, playing Tetris like really fast.
Yeah.
I love that.
You've collaborated with tons of people.
Yeah.
How do you kind of find collaborators?
Usually it's just someone who likes music and it's like, well, let's make music.
Yeah.
When I went to London, I had one phone number. It was Dave Angel. He's a techno DJ from the UK. And Dave was in Auckland playing a gig and he came to this bar I was playing at, Deschler's. And we weren't even playing. We were on break. And I had a Fender Rhodes there. So Dave walks in the bar. He's like, oh, who's that? So that's mine. It's like, oh man, here's my number. If you're ever in London, give me a call. Didn't even hear me play, right?
Just because you had a Rhodes.
Just because I had a Rhodes. So 5 years later or so, I'm in London. I'm like, wait, I've got that guy's number. So I give him a call. And he's like, oh yeah, you know, come down to Swindon where the studio is and let's connect. And we talked about later on, it's like on the phone, he had no fucking clue who I was.
Yeah.
And then when we saw each other at the train station, it's like, oh yeah. So we just made a track that day. It's like, well, let's make some music. And then I caught up with Nathan Haynes, who was living over there at the time, and he introduced me to Phil Asher, who's a dope producer in West London, part of this whole West London community of producers. And I just started doing keyboard sessions with them. It's just like, let's make music. And it was never a question of like, you know, how much am I getting paid or whatever. I was just so happy to be there.
Yeah.
Let's create. Yeah. Like I loved the music they were making, this mix of, you know, funk, house, breaks, jungle, jazz, all this shit mashed together. And I could hear how I could contribute to it musically. Mm. So collaboration was just how it happened. Like I was, you know, they, especially because the roles were pretty clear. They'd be doing beats and production. I'd provide keyboards. And then when I started doing my own production and getting more into MP and beat making and stuff, then I was collaborating more with vocalists and other musicians. And a lot of that came about just through chance. I mean, I got invited to a jam session one day. I was super sick, went down, and Pino Palladino was on bass.
Mm.
You know, I'd just seen D'Angelo's Voodoo tour, so I knew that record backwards, so I knew Pino's shit from that and all everything else he'd done. And we got along so well at the jam session. It ended up being doing a band for 2 months, and he'd just be in the neighborhood. He'd knock on the door. He'd have his bass with him.
Like, yeah.
I guess we're doing music today.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, at this point, it comes down to I'm fortunate to have people, a lot of people dig what I do.
Yep.
Especially musicians, actually, and a lot of vocalists. I think it's something they can relate to, which is, you know, there's points they can relate to stylistically, but it's put together in a slightly different way.
Mm.
So there's an interest to that. And then jazz musicians love it because they usually play in a club to a whole lot of people stroking their chins and in their chairs. And I'll play the same kind of gig my way in a club with people raving and getting down and capoeira circles breaking out and all this shit. It's like, you know, of course musicians want to play my gig, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And I love that because I get to play with musicians I grew up loving. And, you know, I'm the MD for Harvey Mason's band. And I grew up hearing him on Herbie Hancock records. And just, it's crazy.
That is awesome, man. How did you hook up with Omar?
I did a remix for him back in about 10 years ago.
Mm.
One was Joints, and then he did a collaboration on one of my albums, a song called Get Started. And so we had this kind of studio kind of relationship, and we talked about doing something live, but it just hadn't happened. And then I was in Spain at this little club talking to my boy who ran it. I was like, man, I really want to do this thing with Omar. And I knew he couldn't do it because his club was too small. But he's like, well, let's do it. And he got a gig in Madrid and Barcelona, got sponsors in. So we did these first two shows for like half the size of yesterday.
Wow.
Like really exclusive shows.
Yeah.
That was 2 years ago in Spain. And then the next year we did a show in the Canary Islands in this like lava lake cave underground. It was like on another planet.
Yeah.
We played Amsterdam. So we did two shows last year.
Yeah.
And then this is the first kind of longer run we've done. So we're doing six shows this run. And it's the first time we're really getting to actually get in a groove.
Mean.
It's fun though. It's like we talked about the idea and then we couldn't rehearse because we live in different places.
Yeah.
So we got together in Madrid and had an early sound check and straight away I was just like, yeah, this shit's going to work.
I mean, how much would you be able to rehearse even?
Like, well, not a whole lot.
It's improvised, right?
Yeah, but I mean, this, you know, the songs that we're flipping, they have a fundamental structure.
Yep.
And there are certain motifs or riffs or breaks that are signature to that piece of music.
Sure.
So those are kind of used as, that's all the source material that I'm basically live remixing with.
Yep.
So the only thing that is rehearsed sometimes is form. Like a couple of his songs I wanted to do that I didn't know that well. So let's just, you know, run that shit a few times. But yeah, apart from that, it's, if the sound is right, we're good.
Mm.
Sound is everything with this gig. You know, there's so much of vibe in the sound being right.
Yeah, and you can, if it's wrong, you know, you start thinking about it and you start getting pulled out of your kind of moment, right?
Yeah. And I've only just got the drums sounding how I wanted them to sound. It just took so long. Like, working with digital stuff, it's harder, man. But the new Ableton 10, they have a drum bus plugin that, just revolutionized my drums in the last week. I was like, wow, okay. That's some powerful sound sculpting tools there.
Ableton.
Yeah.
So do you use Ableton mostly out of everything?
I came up using Logic in the studio.
Yeah.
But when I transitioned to using software live, Ableton was the obvious kind of landing place. And so now I use Ableton more and more in the studio.
Mm.
But Logic for some things, just I'm more comfortable on it for some things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You also have a hand in some sample packs.
Yeah. I've just, Native Instruments launched a new thing called sounds.com. And it's like Splice. It's like, you know, an infinite number of sound files online.
Yep.
They have like a subscription model thing. You pay like $10 a month. You get unlimited access. So I did some sound packs for them. And I wanted to create packs where it's like that would be a cool part to sample on the record, but I'd like it if there were no drums or bass on that. I just want the guitar part.
Yep.
Some shit like that.
Yep.
Yeah, so they're all called chop packs. So it's like the piano chop, the Rhodes chop, the guitar chop, the drum chop. And yeah, so these little loops that they're in one tempo, one key, but with technology now, everyone's just like, okay, I'll take that, pitch it there. And so it's just material, right? And I like things to be a certain way. So even the guitar packs, like, you know, I've chosen someone specific to do that and kind of curated what they're doing. For the Rhodes one, I'm playing little things that are how I like to bring flavor to a moment. And I'm like, yeah, I could sample that.
Mm.
And, you know, 10 years ago or so, I would have had a feeling about the intellectual property of it. But at this point, I'm like, it's music. There's an infinite supply of it. Like, if I can get up every night and make a new album on stage and then just delete it,
yeah,
then what's the problem with some chords and chord progressions coming out there, you know?
Yeah.
It's just music.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool, man. And so you're creating a lot of them yourself and you're getting other guys to come in and play them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
When did you start, because you know, grew up classical, there's not a lot of improvising there. Was it kind of improvisation? Did that come with jazz or totally. Did it come later on?
Yeah, that came in with the jazz thing.
Yep.
And I mean, I think I grew up as I felt like I was a really immature improviser. Like I'd learn the academics of an approach and kind of rinse that out, which is not a very mature way to improvise. But I feel like I learned a lot of the lessons about what shaped my sound was through the whole experience with club music.
Yep.
Like, you know, things had to be more, like I mentioned before, more functional. So the economy of notes, using as few notes as possible to say that as much as possible, became an idea one would think I would learn through jazz, but I learned through that. I even, you know, people talk about space, like less is more. People talk about that in jazz a lot, but I remember doing a session, my first session for Phil Asher in London. We're doing a remix of his. It's like a house joint, had some vocal and some percussion and some drums. And he wanted me to play some chords and some harmony. So I played like three chords. He's like, that's it. I was like, okay, cool. I'm thinking we're going to pull out some more sounds. It's like, so Phil, it's like, no, that's it. It's like, what? And that joint is a classic to this day.
Mm.
And so that was a lesson in all production, what Phil was doing for sure. But just the idea of less is more.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if you don't need it all, fucking why?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I noticed last night, like you seemed really, really comfortable just taking your time, building up new parts. And part of that is improvising on the night. How did you get that comfortable doing that? Because I think a lot of people would feel a lot of pressure in that moment.
Right.
How do you kind of get around that, you think? Or is it just because you've done it for so long?
Maybe. I mean, the performance is the process.
Yeah.
The performance is not the practice. Those are two different types of performer. You know, there's a lot of performers who perform the practice.
Yep.
And they do it really well. Kudos. That's like amazing. I like to see process. You know, if I go and see some music, I mean, it's cool if it's played well, but I want concept and process. I want the concept to be interesting and unique, and I want your execution to capture my imagination. So for me, sharing that is part of, I'm just like, that's sharing my music, you know, the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way I like to do it is quickly enough put together that it holds attention and hopefully step by step enough to explain itself.
Yeah. Which is
when people don't get it, I'm like, well, what don't you get? I mean,
I think it does, man. Yeah. And it really creates a connection with the audience.
Yeah, right.
They're watching you create something and they can identify with that.
Yeah, they're invested in that process now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the podcast for this week. Thank you for listening, and thank you so much to Mark de Clive Lowe for being so generous with his time and open about his process. He's truly a nice guy and an inspiration to me and to many of you, I'm sure. Check out Mark online at mdcl.tv and facebook.com/mdclmusic. Mark's choice for band of the week is a Japanese experimental soul band called Wonk. Check them out at wonk.tokyo and facebook.com/wonk.tokyo. Also, while you're on Facebook, make sure to check out and like the Musicians Map Facebook page at facebook.com/musiciansmap. This podcast and the website musiciansmap.org is dedicated to sharing knowledge and advice about music and the music industry. It's all about community, honesty, and positive progress. The experiences, stories, and advice shared on the podcast are given freely with the hope that you can relate to them and benefit from them. If you've found this podcast enjoyable or useful, make sure to check out the Musician's Map ebook and audiobook about building success in music. You'll find it at musiciansmap.org/books, Amazon, and Audible. And buying a copy of the book directly contributes to the continuation of this podcast. There's also a free ebook, How to Get Your Music Heard. Go to musiciansmap.org/free-book to get your copy. If you have a suggestion for the podcast or for the YouTube channel, or you just want to get in touch and say hello, please do so via the Musicians Map Facebook group or by email at kane@musiciansmap.org. Thanks for listening and stay positive.